Parshas Chayesara begins with the negotiations, the death of Sarah, and then the negotiations between Avram and Ephron, the Bnei Ches. He purchases a plot of land with a cave, the Maras HaMachpelah, Hebron. So the first two dozen Tzukim or so are busy with the negotiations, the kind of contract negotiations, the details of hammering out the sale. There's one very interesting point, takeaway by a number of the medieval commentators, that is a source of a body of laws which is still very relevant today. It's a close reading of the Psukim indicate, and this is a point made, as I said, by a number of different commentators, that there were actually two separate transactions going on. There was a sale of the plot of land, transfer of the title, the deed, from Ephron himself, the private owner of that particular property, to Avram. Additionally, there were negotiations going on with Bnei Ches, the public, the representatives, the government. The Rishonim make a number of different inferences to the same point, but a number of the Baalei Tosfos and the Ralbag, all arrive at roughly the same point, that Avram, it did not suffice for him to acquire title to the land from Ephron. He also had to obtain permission to build a cemetery from the community at large. And the reason for this, as we'll discuss, is because building a cemetery is considered something which can be a nuisance. Nuisance in the legal sense. The Gemara says you can't build a Beis HaKvaros, you can't build a cemetery without certain setbacks or without permission from the neighbors. And a number of the Rishonim explain that Avram was concerned about this too. Either this was Chittite law, or Avram was doing Lefim Meshuras HaDin. Ethically, he felt he had to do this. He had to get permission from the Bnei Ches, from Ephron's community, in order to build a cemetery in their midst. So the Ralbag, for example, for those not familiar with his style, in addition to his running commentary on the biblical narrative, he also has two or three times a parasha or so, he also writes what he calls toalios, lessons, the plural of toalet, lessons we learn from the parasha. They can be theological, ritual, mitzvah, psychological, philosophical. So this one he has is midos, which is what he considers proper conduct between man and fellow man. He says we learn from the Torah's careful account of the negotiations between Ephron and Ches and Avram, we learn that a person should not do anything in his property which can cause injury or discomfort or inconvenience to his neighbor, unless they agree. That's why his inference from the text is that we find Bnei Ches are repeatedly mentioned. Avram deals with Ephron. He also deals with Bnei Ches, apparently. On the whole, it says that he bowed to the Bnei Ches back in Pasuk Zayin, Vayidaber Itam, he spoke to them. Why are they involved? This is a private transaction. Nobody should have been involved but Avram, Ephron, and of course their lawyers. But beyond that, why is the Bnei Ches being involved? So the Ralbag says this is because they had to sign off in order to give him a variance, in order to get permission to build a cemetery in their neighborhood. He says, Vayishtachu Avram lefnei Am Haaretz. Again, he involved Am Haaretz. Vayidaber el Ephron ba'oznei Am Haaretz. Repeatedly, he involves the Am Haaretz, the Bnei Ches, because their permission was required to get the property properly zoned for a cemetery. We have a number of other versions.
I always thought that, we also have a law that you're not allowed to sell to the stranger. Like, you're not allowed to sell to non-Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. So I thought that Bnei Ches, right, this is a tribal land, and the reason why they needed to get permission from them is he's a stranger. He's a Gevurah Toshav. Who says we allow non-Hittites to own land? It seems like a very legalistic way of reading.
Yeah, so that's an interesting idea. I have no doubt that, right, you certainly can find other explanations for why the Hittites might have had to be involved. Perhaps, as you're saying, there was a covenant, or there was a general national or social convention that we didn't rent to, that we didn't sell to outsiders. It's certainly possible, yes. But, I wouldn't be surprised if other commentators say that. But the fact is, we do find kind of one attitude which is common among a number of Rishonim, whether it's compelling or not, but the number of Rishonim do understand like this, that it was specifically because of the cemetery. I hear your alternative, though. The Chizkuni, also from the Tosafist school, the Chizkuni emphasizes Avram was bowing. He says, and Avram bows twice. He says, the first time Avram bows is in Pasuk Zayin. It says, Vayakam Avram, Vayishtachu Lam Haaretz Levnei Ches. He bowed, it says, Avram arose, he stood up, and he bowed to the community. Later, Avram bows again. It says, Vayishtachu Avram lefnei Am Haaretz. The second time it does not say he stood up. So again, the Baalei Tosfos, as we've noted, were very close readers of the text, very, very focused on the basic sense of the text. So the Chizkuni says, the first time he was bowing to the community at large, And when you stand in the center of a gathering, there are people behind you. So we have to stand up and turn around kind of to make sure he bowed to everyone in the room. The second time he was really bowing to Ephron. It said, Lefnei Amar, they were witnessing, but it was really to Ephron. Ephron was right across the desk from him, so he just genuflected to Ephron without having to stand up. But again, he says, the reason there were two separate bowings and two separate obeisances, there were two separate transactions going on, this is because, again, he had to get the title to the property as well as permission to build the cemetery. Now, again, some of the Rishonim say that he got permission from the public, from the broader community. Other Rishonim, other of the Baalei Tosfos suggest that he was getting permission from the government, what we would call either the zoning board or some kind of legislative body, elders, the village elders, whoever they were. He says that he had to, the Hadar Zakenim, another Tosafist commentary, says that he had to get permission from what he calls the Gedolei Ha'er, the village elders, the city leaders, the city fathers, the councilmen, whatever they were. They had to sign off on this project, give him a variance, as we would say. And again, he has yet another inference from the Psukim. This is also noted by many commentators. When the Torah describes the transaction, the transfer of title of the field from Ephron to Avram, so in Pasuk Yud Zayin, it says, Vayakum stay Ephron Hashem Machpelah, the field arose figuratively, it got up and it transferred, with ownership was transferred to Avram. Several Psukim later in Pasuk Chaf, it says again, Vayakum asad amar asher bo, the field got up again. So again, people ask, and the Torah, pretty parsimonious with words, usually here the Torah says Vayakum twice. So again, the Hadar Zakenim finds a reference to the same idea that there were actually two transactions, there were two legal things taking effect here. One was title of the property per se to Avram. The second was the awarding him of a right under the local zoning laws to utilize the property as a cemetery. The Riva, another one of the Tosafos, says the same thing. And again, the Ralbag explicitly links this to the what we call in Halacha Nizkei Shcheinim. The law is literally the torts of neighbors. In general, this is a body of Halacha which regulates how neighbors have to conduct themselves. That they can't just do whatever they want. You can't just say, it's my property, I'm going to do whatever I want, and the neighbors, they can take care of themselves. The halacha is not like that. There is extensive halacha in Bava Basra, and Shulchan Aruch, and Chashan Mishpat, about how neighbors are expected to behave vis-a-vis each other. And this is kind of a proto-example of that between Avram and the native Hittites of Eretz Canaan. And as Ralbag notes, as he alludes to, as I mentioned earlier, cemetery is actually one of the specific examples discussed in Bava Basra of something that you can't do. The Mishnah doesn't say you can't do it at all. The Mishnah says in the second parak in Bava Basra, you have to have a certain setback, not a very large setback. It's only 50 amos, which would be 75, 100 feet, which is not a huge amount. But the principle is there, and the interesting thing about Nizkei Shcheinim, the laws of neighbors and the torts of neighbors in general, is that many of the concrete and specific examples discussed in the Talmud are not really relevant today. We don't live the same way, we don't have the same types of substances and usages, but the principles, as in many areas of law and halacha, the principles are relevant to us, and the principles certainly do apply today. We have Dinei Torah, we have many disputes, there is still a living literature on this about what neighbors can and can't do, and for the rest of our talk, we'll discuss several examples of this, how the principles and rules established by the Talmud and the later authorities, what some of them are, and how they apply to the contemporary situations. Now, the rules themselves tend to be very technical. They're difficult to appreciate properly without a very thorough examination of the source material. We're not going to delve that deeply into the early primary sources in the Talmud. We'll instead kind of just discuss abstraction, some of the general principles, and how the later authorities have applied them to modern situations. Now, one very important idea, which one finds voiced using similar language in a bunch of different later authorities, is an idea of the Chazon Ish. It's kind of an intuitive idea, but he articulates it in an acute way. He says, unlike, let's say, the classic torts, the famous, we learn about my ox that gores your ox, and those kind of things are really established very much based on first principles. If I'm negligent, I'm responsible, what the standard of negligence is, how direct the damage is. We kind of use very theoretical, very abstract philosophical categories, and we then apply that to real-world situations. The laws of neighbors, many poskim have been forced to concede, are a little bit less theoretical, a little bit less abstract than many other areas of halacha. Oliver Wendell Holmes talks about how the life of the law is not logic but experience, and when it comes to Nizkei Shcheinim, there is an idea one finds in many authorities that At some point, it becomes almost futile to try to fit everything into clean, theoretical, lumdish categories that Chazal, the sages of the Talmud, have to basically establish workable, pragmatic rules for how neighbors can get along. And sometimes they simply establish rules that would maximize harmony and efficiency and general well-being without necessarily strictly extrapolating everything from basic, simple first principles. And that's kind of what we'll find. Poskim have often invoked common sense principles like, it's easier for you to move, it's easier for you to move, your need is not that great, your need is greater. We find the kind of the flavor of much of the halacha, and I think we'll see some examples today, the flavor of the halacha often is that it really depends at the end of the day how much we're really asking and what the most reasonable and overall what will maximize the welfare and harmony of neighbors, how we do things, which is not always the approach we take in halacha, but in this case is a particular bias, as I understand it, in that direction. The Chazon Ish's example, he's talking about one of the types of nuisance that we talk about. Again, I use the word nuisance. I don't mean to make a judgment. I mean, it's kind of a legal term. The things that neighbors can do that can annoy other neighbors is noise, different types of noises. And again, we'll discuss a little bit time of the day and what kind of noise, but one of the things they talk about is noises. So the Chazon Ish gives an example. He says, let's say a family has young children and they cry at night. They make a lot of noise. So I'm not sure what a neighbor complains. I'm not sure what the neighbor wants. He wants you to put your kid up for adoption. I'm not sure what exactly he's asking for. Again, if he's asking for spend $1,000 to soundproof some walls, maybe that's a reasonable request. I haven't seen an actual discussion of that. But the Chazon Ish says, in general, you can't ask somebody, you can't complain that the fellow's kid is making noise. That's what kids do. Having kids is part of normal social life. Kids making noise is part of normal social life. And to demand that there be absolute silence from a family with small children is not a reasonable request. It's all the examples he says, Talmudically and the later sources, where we demand that people shush their noise, those are all discretionary noises, where it's a particular line of business I'm in, well, do something else, do a different kind of business, or take your business to your office, or you know, get a factory somewhere. Or this is your hobby, well, get a different hobby, or don't throw loud parties at night, have the loud parties at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, or whatever it is. But something which is a fundamental necessity of living like a normal person, that you can't ask people to leave, again, because the underlying rule is that the halakhas are meant to allow people to live reasonably, you're making some kind of reasonable compromises, asking somebody, you know, not to have children or to, you know, get rid of his children is not reasonable. Again, if there is a practical solution, if soundproofing can be done at a reasonable cost, maybe yes. If it's going to cost $70,000 to soundproof the whole house, maybe not. Again, I haven't seen actual discussion of soundproofing, but this is kind of the attitude we find Poskim taking. We have to evaluate very often how important something is. We'll discuss a little bit later an interesting tshuva of Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin in his Bnei Banim, who talks about a case of an older person who didn't like the children playing balls. In Israel, they had these, I guess we would call them apartment buildings. They have these chaterot with buildings that have joint yards, and the kids play ball, and it makes a racket. That's what kids do. And this other fellow complained, and Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin goes back and forth, but one of his key arguments, we'll discuss a little more later, is that kids need ball, kids games, and that's what kids do. Asking a kid not to play is just completely not reasonable. But we'll discuss that a little more later. So I want to just begin by a few basic case studies. These are all examples that have Talmudic roots, but also have great practical application. First one I want to discuss is smoking. Cigarette, tobacco, pipe. Now, we have several questions here. The first question is, which is not really our topic tonight, but just to go through the history a little bit, is it permitted to smoke at all? Someone who, we're not necessarily talking about someone who's already addicted to cigarettes, but someone who is not addicted, who's still discretionary, thinking of taking up the habit, does halacha allow cigarette smoking? It's a dangerous habit. So the literature, the halachic literature on smoking goes back, what I eventually want to get to is the question of smoking in public places, smoking in a shul, smoking in a restaurant, a bar, smoking in an apartment where the ventilation will tend to pass the smoke to your neighbors. So obviously there are laws, there are government laws, federal laws, and airplanes, I guess, and local laws. So those laws should be followed. The Poskim, I think, would generally accept that you should follow those laws. I'm discussing more theoretically in the absence of laws or in situations where the law doesn't cover, to the extent that those still exist. So in these situations where there isn't any controlling law, in the absence of law, what is the native halacha toward smoking where others complain about it? And I just want to go through first a little bit of a general survey of the halachic literature on smoking to put this discussion in context. So the literature on smoking goes back about 300 years, begins in the 18th century, even the 17th century, actually, I guess when tobacco began to become common in Europe. The earliest tshuvas, going back to the 17th century, they did not know, they did not believe tobacco was harmful. On the contrary, they thought tobacco was good for you. It helped the digestion, it helped the nerves. It was considered a good and useful habit. As a matter of fact, the earliest literature going back to the 17th century generally revolves around two questions, not whether it's a health risk. They didn't know it was a health risk. It usually revolves around on Yom Tov, can you smoke on the Chag, and on fast days, Tisha B'Av, Shavuos or Tammuz. Yom Kippur, it's not relevant because you can't light the cigarette, you can't do the fire stuff, but on Yom Tov, where you can use fire, or on fast days where fire was not prohibited, so can you smoke? So there's a lot of literature back and forth on this. We're not going to get into this. Until today, there are poskim who do allow smoking on Yom Tov. Some people still do. So I'll just mention one. This is a complete digression, but it's just one of the most fascinating things I've ever seen in the halakhic literature. One of the most vehement poskim, who most vehemently anti-smoking on fast days, the question was on fast days, is it considered a form of eating or drinking or prohibited pleasure that you should give up for a fast day? So one of the most vehemently anti-smoking authorities was Rav Chaim Ben Venisti, the author of the Knesset Gdola, one of the most important Sephardic authorities of the last 500 years. He was vehemently opposed, apparently, to smoking on fast days. He used very strong language against it, and many later authorities quote him as a major early authority who prohibited smoking on fast days. Now, in the 19th century, we have a fascinating tshuva from Rav Yosef Zecharia Stern, the quintessential Litvish posek. He's doing a kind of survey of the literature on smoking on fast days. And in an aside, he says as follows. He was a Litvish, you know, very traditional posek, but very well-read and very astute and very erudite fellow. He writes as follows. He says, many poskim invoke the Knesset Gdola of Chaim Ben Venisti as a leading anti-smoking authority. I want you to know, he says, you really have to take that in historical context. What's the historical context? Rav Chaim Ben Venisti lived in the time of Shabbosai Tzvi. Like many of the Rabbanim, he was caught up in the maelstrom and the controversy around Shabbosai Tzvi. He started out as an anti-Sabbatean, like most of the Rabbanim. At some point, when the controversy in Izmir, Smyrna, his city, became particularly acute, at one point, he went over to Shabbosai Tzvi's side. He became a believer for a while, a few months. He actually secured the position of the chief rabbi of Smyrna because of his support for the Sabbateans, who were the dominant faction of the city at the time. Like most sane people, he saw the error of his ways when Shabbosai Tzvi apostatized and accepted Islam. He dropped Shabbosai Tzvi and he became one of the leading anti-Sabbatean crusaders for the rest of his rabbinic career. And he was rehabilitated, and he's today, you know, considered one of the most important Sephardic authorities. He had this brief error, which many Rabbanim did at the time, where he followed Shabbosai Tzvi, but it was, you know, an honest mistake. He repented of it when it became clear that he was not the real thing, and so on. Now, what does all this have to do with smoking? So Shabbosai Tzvi, one of his, you know, he had infamous antinomian tendencies. He started to abrogate certain halachas. Some of the key halachas he began to dispense with were those that had to do with the fast days. He said the Geula is coming and Mashiach is on his way, and therefore we can stop being so stringent about the remembrances of the Churban and the remembrances of the Gullus. So fast days he was particularly lenient on. Says Rav Yosef Zecharia Stern, we know, you know, there is no implacable enemy like the true believer who sees the error of his ways. Those people who were formerly believers became the bitterest, most adamant, most vehement opponents of Shabbosai Tzvi. So Rav Chaim Ben Venisti, because he had temporarily been seduced by Shabbosai Tzvi, went to the other extreme, became a fanatic anti-Sabbatean, and any leniency, anything to do with leniency on a fast day, he came down like a ton of bricks on. So just be aware, he said, there's a historical context to this, and you shouldn't ignore what he said necessarily, but just be aware that the thing has to be taken in historical context. But in any event, for the first two centuries or so after the literature begins on smoking, the discussion was about fast days and Yom Tov. It's not until the mid to late 20th century that we begin to see halakhic literature about the danger of smoking. The discussion begins in the late 60s, as far as I know, continues on through the 70s, 80s, and then down to the 21st century. And if you study the literature, it's quite interesting. You can see a kind of sea change in the overall consensus, the overall attitude of the poskim, as the science became clearer and more incontrovertible, as the general understanding of just how dangerous smoking is penetrated to the public consciousness, the poskim began to become increasingly opposed to it, increasingly willing to forbid it, to the extent that in the last couple of years or so, There were actually a couple of rulings out of Israel from Sephardic Poskim, actually, who ruled that someone who smokes should not be an aide, should not be a witness at a wedding or divorce because he's considered a sinner, someone who is ignoring the biblical imperative to take care of your life and health, and such a person should not be an aide. Now, I think that's probably going a little too far. It's certainly a common habit. People are melam mitzvos, people have rationalizations. I don't think you really become posel aides for this. It just goes to show kind of how far, these are very traditional poskim. These are not, you know, you do find in general that, as you might expect, the more kind of modern the poskim are, the more open they are to Western culture, kind of the quicker they were to accept the science that smoking is bad for you. Some of the YU poskim, fairly early on, Rav Schechter, Rav Willig, I think, were among the earlier ones to take a hard line against against smoking. The RCA put out a document some decade or two ago, you know, issuing a kind of formal statement on how smoking is absolutely prohibited. Rav Chaim Jachter, a very distinguished dayan from Elizabeth in the RCA world, came out with some very, very strong articles vehemently. He mentions he lost, I think, his father or father-in-law to smoking, so he feels very strongly about it. But in general, even the very traditional European kind of poskim increasingly became aware of how dangerous it was, and it kind of cuts across the ideological divide. Even some of the very reactionary poskim issued statements flat out prohibiting smoking. One of my favorites is the Debrecina Rav, Rav Moshe Stern, very much an old world, Baropar, Hungarian posik. In spite of the fact that great Rabbanim, Hasidic Rabbanim, Rosh Yeshiva of earlier generations did smoke, nevertheless, he says unequivocally one may not smoke today. He finds it necessary to explain how could it be that earlier great rabbis smoked if we don't. Some of us would just say because they didn't know the science. It's no slight on them that they didn't know science that nobody knew 100 years ago. But he nevertheless finds other reasons why. One of his most interesting reasons, I don't know if this is really scientifically correct, but he says, he sounds like an environmentalist almost. He says that back in Europe, he says, the air was pure. We had our little villages and people breathed pure air and the lungs were tough and people were healthy. He says, today, he says, there's so much filth and the soot and chemicals and pollutants. The cities are all fighting, losing battles against it. The environment is so bad. Our lungs are ravaged and pockmarked by all kinds of garbage that we breathe in all day. Perhaps today our lungs are weaker. Be that as it may, he says, he has other reasons. He says, clearly the data shows that smoking is terrible for you and smoking it should be prohibited. And that's in general the consensus that you get from the later poskim, the contemporary poskim. One of the great holdouts, and this takes us to our discussion about the objections of neighbors, others to smoking, one of the great holdouts really was Rav Moshe Feinstein, the leading American authority in 20th century America. He has a number of tshuvas on smoking, at least four to my knowledge. They begin about in the 60s or 70s. The last one that I know of is in 84. In none of them does he come out and prohibit smoking. He's not excited about it. In all the tshuvas, he concedes it's a terrible habit, it's an indulgence for no reason, and it's dangerous, and even if there are heterim, he says a person certainly shouldn't do such a thing, you know, why put your life in danger? But he's not willing to flat-out rule that it's prohibited. At least as late as 84, he was still arguing that even on Yontif, it's permitted because the standard on Yontif is it has to be what we call shavel chal nefesh. It has to be a very common, ubiquitous, widespread, whatever the exact standard is, has to be fairly common. At least as late as 84, he was still saying that it was a common enough habit that it was permitted even on Yom Tov, and obviously a fortiori during the week. And now some of his students, some of his closest followers have argued that if he knew the science that we know today, he would have accepted that it was prohibited. Be that as it may, he never came out explicitly to forbid smoking. Many others did, as we mentioned earlier, some of the names, perhaps most notably among the Haredi moderns would be the Tzitz Eliezer, Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, who in some ways was very conservative, but also on medical issues, he was very well-versed and he knew the science and he was ferociously opposed to smoking. He says, you're killing yourself, you can't do that. Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, one of Rav Moshe's very close followers, also says, crazy, you can't smoke. Of course not, he says, it's like lying down on a busy highway. You're killing yourself, he says, there's no hetter for such a thing. But Rav Moshe, in one of his tshuvas in 81, discusses the question of whether the neighbors have the right to object. But he was talking about smoking in a public place, like a shul or a bis medrash. He wanted to know if the other members have the right to object if you want to smoke. You yourself have the right to smoke, he says. Can the neighbors object? And Rav Moshe says, yes, they can. Even if it's not inherently lethal and usher for you, but the neighbors have the right, the other members of the public that are breathing in your smoke have the right to object. And he makes basically two types of arguments. One of them is simply, the two pretty much that you can probably all think of. One of them is that smoking is dangerous, and secondhand smoke is dangerous too. He doesn't quote the literature, but apparently science is a little bit behind behind active smoking, but today it is widely recognized, certainly, that secondhand smoke, passive smoke, environmental smoke, whatever it's called, is really bad for you too. What they call side stream smoke from the end of the cigarettes, what they call mainstream smoke, the stuff you exhale and comes back out again, it's really bad for you. And all the major health organizations, Surgeon General, WHO, American Cancer Society, one after another, have all agreed that it's really bad. A few of the figures I saw, they think in the United States, secondhand smoke is responsible for something like 7,000 additional lung cancer deaths a year. Cardiovascular deaths from cardiovascular circulatory disease in the 30,000s a year from secondhand smoke specifically. So it's, the consensus is strong, maybe not quite as strong as active smoking, but the overwhelming consensus, it's really bad for you. It kills, and aside from causing other problems, asthma, kids, different problems. So Ramosha says, A, that the neighbors have the right to say it harms us, it's bad for us, so we don't like it. B, they just don't like the smoke. The smoke is unpleasant. Many non-smokers have a physically difficult time being exposed to smoke. It's just really unpleasant for them. My wife, for example, we had an apartment situation where smoke would come through the vents. It really, really bothered her, in addition to the question of the health risk. So many people are like that too. So both these reasons, Ramosha argues, based on classic Talmudic and halakhic precedents, both these reasons would be sufficient reasons to forbid smoking in public places where others are affected. Rav Yosef Shalom Elyashiv, also writing in 81, does not agree. Either it may have even been in direct response to Ramosha. Rav Elyashiv felt that, again, he strongly argues that menschlichkeit, that musr, that just empathy for others, certainly one should try not to smoke where it affects others. It's certainly the right thing to do, he says. But in terms of strict din, in terms of the letter of the law, he does not feel that we can strictly prohibit smoking. He argues that insofar as smoking is a generally socially accepted habit, not only is it permitted for the smoker himself, it's permitted for him to smoke in a public place. And even though, again, he suggests the person should try not to, and it's really not so appropriate, but at the end of the day, he says, according to strict halacha, since it is not something which is considered flat out directly dangerous, now again, all these types of rulings have to be analyzed in terms of what we know now in terms of the science, whether he would have written quite the way he did if he had the greater and more clearer understanding of the science that we have today, we'll never know, I suppose, unless he's written anything further or unless people, his students, can quote him on a later ruling of his. But the fact is that in a formal documented ruling of 81, he was not willing to prohibit smoking even in a public place. Rav Osner of Bnei Brak, also one of the leading Haredi poskim, did take for granted that you could prohibit smoking in a public place. I just have one line I excerpted from him. He says, Chalila, heaven forbid, he says, La'ashim makomas tiburim. Absolutely, he says, you can't smoke in a public place because the smoke itself, meaning even the secondhand smoke, is bad for people, like kasher nisbar b'chakira, as investigation, meaning scientific research has shown even the secondhand smoke is bad for other people and they have the right to object. Now, I always felt for many years, it always seemed to me that applying the classic laws of neighbors and of mazik and nizak is really not necessarily the right paradigm. Certainly when discussing spaces that are technically private property, let's say we discuss a restaurant or a bar, it would seem to me that, again, putting aside whatever the law of the land is about this, in terms of what halacha would say, in the absence of any laws, it always seemed to me that this is the wrong paradigm to discuss hezek. It's my property. I, the bar owner, I, the restaurant owner, can set whatever rules I want. I can decide my restaurant is a smoke-free zone. If you want to smoke, you're not welcome. I can decide my restaurant is a smoke-full zone, and if you don't like smoking, go somewhere else. But certainly in a private space, I would have thought that there are no rules. It's up the same way in a private house. I can tell you I want to have a party. There'll be no smoking. If you want to smoke, don't come to my party. I can have a party saying there will be smoke. If you don't like smoke, then you may not want to come to this party. Obviously, I can make those rules, and I would have argued that even a space that's open to the public commercially, it should still be up to me, the owner, to make the rules. And even in spaces like a Beis Medrash or a Beis Knesset, I might have argued that the same way we recognize that every shul is not a complete democracy, and that maybe the people in the shul appoint a board, they appoint committees, and however it works in every shul, ultimately there are those who set rules, and they get to decide, can you bring food into the sanctuary, can you do this, can you do that? So somebody makes rules, and the rules are made by, I would have thought, again, it's up to the community to set rules, and they can set rules whatever they want. Nevertheless, Rav Moshe and Rav Elyashiv and Rav Osner are really treating shuls, Rav Moshe and Rav Elyashiv are treating shuls as public places where the classic laws of the regulations of neighbors apply, and these halachas either yes or no, but we apply the classic paradigms of neighbors to determine whether you can smoke or not. I did see one other approach, a writer named Rabbi Baumel, who wants to argue an even stricter view. He wants to argue that joint spaces, public spaces like shuls, are really considered shutfus, considered jointly owned property by all the members of the congregation, and therefore any one of them, he brings technical arguments for this, any one of them has a veto over the smoking. If any one person doesn't like it, even if it wouldn't be considered an official nuisance according to the rules of halacha, he can say, this is my space too, and you can't put smoke in my space because it belongs to me too. He's looking at the shul not as controlled by the board, but as every single person has an ownership right in the shul. Any person, therefore, has the right to object to something that's being done that genuinely bothers him. That's another position. But in any event, there isn't really a clear consensus on what the rules would be in terms of prohibiting smoking, assuming it wasn't lethally dangerous as we know it is today, assuming it was just relatively minor nuisance. What would the halachas be? We find some very different approaches taken in the poskim. Another example I want to talk about a little bit is the idea of opening an office, or specifically a medical office, a clinic in a residential area. This is actually something that's discussed, this exact case is discussed in Talmudic sources already. The halacha is that you are generally not allowed to open up a professional establishment in near neighbors who object to it in a residential area. The reason is because it makes noise, the commotion of the, even if the work itself that you do is quiet, you're a doctor, you're not making any noise in the actual treatment of the patients, but the traffic, the pedestrian traffic, say we have motor traffic, whatever it is, the traffic is both noisy as well as it inconveniences the neighbors, it clogs up the roads, it clogs up the parking lots, it clogs up the chatzer, so it's inconvenient and noisy, and that gives the neighbors the right to object. So, there is, however, an exception. The Talmud makes an exception for mitzvah. Specifically, the Talmud makes an exception for schools that teach Torah, Tinoko Shel Beis Rabban. The paramount importance of preserving the convenience and the practicality of having schools overrides the normal concern, even though that would be something that would be noisy and the neighbors might not like. When it comes to a yeshiva, teaching Torah to children, that is mutar, that is permitted. Now, there is some debate about this in the medieval sources, but the consensus view of the Shulchan Aruch rules that this can be generalized to any mitzvah purpose is a legitimate justification for overriding at least this particular rule of noise and traffic and commotion. You're allowed to do things for mitzvah purposes even if the neighbors have some inconvenience.
So that would apply to shuls also? Not just maybe
yes, shul is a specific example mentioned by some of the poskim. I think the Shulchan Aruch does not mention it, but I believe the Torah does, and shul is one of the classic examples, and we'll see how some of the considerations we're going to mention soon apply to that too. Now, there is, however, some debate about what kind of mitzvahs are included, and the confusion, the debate, comes from the fact that the Shulchan Aruch and earlier sources seem to rule that a mohel, a person who does bris milah, and a physician are both prohibited. So the poskim will ask, doing bris milah is certainly a mitzvah, healing sick people is certainly a mitzvah. So these are also mitzvahs, so why should they not be permitted under the same rules? So one answer given by the Taz is that the only mitzvahs that are permitted are those that require inherently a public office. A doctor can make house calls. A mohel can make house calls. A shul needs, by definition, needs a public space for people to gather. A school also, to be effective, needs a public gathering. Doctors and ritual circumcisers can make house calls. Now, many poskim object to this. They say it's certainly not true today, even though some doctors maybe can, but other doctors need equipment. Rav Osner, again, has a tshuva about a dentist. He says he obviously can't take his drills and his chairs. He can't truck them around. It's just not practical, he says. And many doctors need equipment. They need, and even without the equipment, the logistics of it. If the doctor has to spend half his day traveling, that cuts down the amount of time he has to see patients. So either he has to charge a lot more, or he has to see fewer patients, or both. And so for many reasons, it's not practical for doctors, certainly not today, and perhaps not even in the time of Chazal. As a matter of fact, some poskim say in the time of Chazal, before they had phones, before they had internet and phones, patients had to go to the doctor's office. How would the doctor know who's sick? And what's he going to do? Make ride circuits around the city, knocking on doors, saying everyone okay here? You know, they have to have an office for people to come. There's no other practical way to do it. Many poskim don't like this idea of the Taz. So again, if we went with the Taz, we would say a doctor's usher. Insofar as he could make house calls, it's usher. If you say he can't make house calls, it might be mutter. Another idea proposed by the Avinezer of Sachachov and Rav Shlomo Zalman Arbach is as follows. They want to argue that it depends what kind of mitzvah we're dealing with. Not all mitzvahs have the special dispensation of annoying the neighbors. And they make a distinction as follows, a very kind of reasonable, common sense distinction. They want to argue as follows. Something which is not seen as a human need. Without the mitzvah, people might not do it at all. Giving your kids a religious education. If you're not committed to religion, if the cost is too high, if it's too difficult, you might send your kid to public school. So having a Jewish school, you do it for the mitzvah of it. You want your kid to be taught Torah, you want your kid to be raised Jewish. There, Chazal were very concerned. If we make it too difficult, if we set the bar too high, we're going to lose people. We're going to lose everyone. We're going to lose some people. Some people won't go to yeshiva, and that'll be terrible. So therefore, they allow the dispensation of annoying the neighbors to some extent, because otherwise, people might not be sending their kids to yeshiva. Says Avnei Nezer, says Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, when it comes to doctors, even if it's not a mitzvah, which it is, but even if it's not a mitzvah, he says, people are going to seek out doctors. People are going to find a way to go to the doctors. We tell you that even if we make it a little more difficult, at the end of the day, the doctor will find some way to open. People will find some way of finding medical treatment. It's not solely a religious issue. It's that too. But people will be independently motivated to go seek medical treatment, and therefore, there wasn't quite the same need to incentivize you to smooth it out because people will find some way to... People will find some way to open medical establishments. He brings a kind of proof. He says one of the examples the Shulchan Aruch says of a non-mitzvah facility, which is usher, is the idea of a school for secular studies. You need the neighbor's permission. Yeshivas where they teach Torah are different. Secular schools not. Says the Avnei Nezer, we know that teaching your kid a trade is a mitzvah. We say on Shabbos, v'tinoch l'lam do sefer, we say, the Gemara on Shabbos says, teaching your kid a trade is important. If you don't teach your kid to make a living, he's gonna live a life of crime. So we know teaching your kid to earn a living is a mitzvah. So why isn't that also a mitzvah? You can really go one step further. You can ask, the Chasam Sofer makes this point. He says, in certain contexts in halacha, we say actually making a living is a mitzvah. And for certain purposes in halacha, we treat any business endeavor as a mitzvah to some extent. The halacha is you're not supposed to embark on a sea voyage within 3 days of Shabbos for various reasons, unless for the purpose of a mitzvah, and many poskim say that making a living is a mitzvah, because it's important to be able to survive. So how come Chazal didn't give the same dispensation of annoying the neighbors for those mitzvahs? Says Avnei Nezer, because those mitzvahs, even if we make your life difficult, you'll find a way to earn a living. We don't have to, we're not worried that you're going to give up on making a living if we make it a little more difficult for you to find a good site for your office. Things which are purely religious in nature, like a yeshiva, you don't have the same inherent motivation to do it. So for that, they felt it of paramount importance to make it easy, because otherwise, some people might not be going to yeshiva at all.
What defines in this sort of literature a residential neighborhood?
So residential neighborhood is actually, I was cheating a little bit. That's not actually a term that appears in the literature.
Right.
They just use terms like not near the neighbors. Now, anywhere where there are neighbors, basically, would be usher. Halacha does not distinguish between areas that are zoned as residential or not. What are you expected to do? You're either supposed to find a site. Again, most of the halachas deal with setbacks. Most of the halachas are not indefinite. They say things like not more than 50 feet away, not less than 50 feet away, or mostly you're dealing with limited halachas. So you would have to find a place that was either far enough away from any neighbors or far enough from neighbors who are objecting to it, or you pay off neighbors in some neighborhood. But basically, right, halacha doesn't really distinguish between the classic sources don't really distinguish between the character of the neighborhood. There are some sources who say, in many areas we do say that whoever comes first wins. So if, for example, the source of the nuisance was there first, the halakhas are quite complicated in this area, but in certain cases we say, if the source of the nuisance is here first and then the injured party moves in afterwards, he can't ask the other guy move out because he was here first. Then it would depend simply who moved there first, but halakha doesn't really have any formal designation of residential area versus commercial versus professional. So some posts can say this thing, that medical offices would be prohibited because halacha didn't have to give you the dispensation because you'll find some way to build a doctor's office. And the contemporary posts can actually go back and forth on this. Some of them feel that absolutely healing people is a mitzvah and therefore it should be permitted just like yeshivas are. Other posts can say no for the reasons of the Avnei Nezer and for other reasons, that building medical offices should not be permitted because you'll find another way to do it, or for other arguments. I did actually see one author try to claim that healing people is generally not a mitzvah, it's only if it's a life-threatening illness, so I guess oncologists and cardiovascular surgeons, yes, but many more minor doctors who are dealing with less serious ailments are not, but it seems to me, I was not able to research the matter fully, but I think that this is very much an outlier position. I think the strong consensus in halacha is that any medical treatment is a mitzvah. The doctor doing any kind of work where he helps out and improves the lot and improves the health of a fellow Jew is a mitzvah. The analogy very often is made to Hashem HaSaveda, where returning even a lost mitten, it can be worth $5, is still a mitzvah, or even less than that. And the Gemara says returning somebody's life or even somebody's health, returning his guf, is also a mitzvah. It's even more than returning his property. I think the implication certainly is that the consensus view certainly is that even non-life-threatening medical procedures, most dental procedures, are not going to be life-threatening. But still, I think there's no question the pain and the quality of life, so to speak, is good enough. It's surely a mitzvah. So again, we find contemporary debate among the poskim as to whether doctors would be allowed to open in areas where they're too close to private citizens, to residential units, who are complaining about it.
So why can't the mohel? Why would they say that the mohel can't? I mean, that's
so again, it's a subject of debate. The Taz argues that anything that doesn't need a central office should be done by making house calls, and that's why mohel is usher. Other poskim say mohel is mutter, and they explain the Shulchan Aruch differently. The Rashi just said it's mutter. Yeah, I don't know if there's a accepted halacha lemaisa, but there definitely are those who... The Gemara uses an ambiguous term. The term used is uman. So uman sometimes in Talmudic literature means bloodletter, and sometimes it means mohel. Some poskim say mohel, other poskim object and say no, that would be mitzvah, that would be mutter. So they say it means bloodletter. Even though bloodletter is a health thing, it's a relatively minor health thing. It's just it's like more like a massage than a serious curing of an illness. So yeah.
Private business, like say you were let's say a restaurant versus a grocery store, because I can remember in the early 80s I was a small little thing, even though I was not so, I was smaller than other kids. I remember being burnt by cigarettes like in the grocery store. But if you want to smoke in a restaurant, it's sort of optional to go there. But if you have one grocery store, in a small town, it's not quite optional to
Maybe. I just want to get to one last point, and then I'll take more questions. Just finish off one more example, and then I'll just throw open the floor to general questions. I mentioned earlier Rabbi Henkin's tshuva. He talks about ball playing. He has this case where somebody was an older person was objecting to the neighbors playing with the children playing ball. So he has a long tshuva, very erudite, as his tshuvas always are. And for much of the tshuva, he analyzes it through the perspective of technical. He compares it to smoke. Smoke itself, the modern question is tobacco smoke. The Talmudic sources deal with oven smoke or different types of industrial smoke. And there are rules. Not all smoke is always usher. It depends how much smoke there is, whether the smoke is constant around the clock or intermittent or occasional. He actually raises an interesting question, which comes up in the smoking question too. He says, let's say ball playing. So one kid plays ball, he plays for an hour a day. Maybe that's not so bad. It's only an hour a day, you'll survive. But if all the kids play and all day there's ball playing, it's constant. The halacha differentiates between constant and intermittent. So is this called intermittent or is this called constant? Each kid is intermittent, but from the victim's perspective, it's constant. He raises this question. I don't think he has a clear conclusion on it. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in his tshuva on smoking, he takes for granted that that's called constant. He says that even though each person's cigarette is only a few minutes a day, but if you're in a smoky environment where there are enough people that will be smoke all day, he says that's constant. Rabbi Henkin goes back and forth, discusses whether if you're particularly susceptible to noise, you can have a special objection. He goes back and forth on the technical discussion of whether ball playing should be prohibited or not. And he's willing to concede that in some cases the guy might have a claim, at least if he limits his request to certain circumstances, he might have a good claim. Then he makes the point I made before, that I began with, that he says, all this is if we would consider ball playing a luxury, an optional thing like smoking, like running your industrial oven all day, then we can find all these rules for intermittent, constant, how much smoke, is it bothering, can you prove that it's bothering you, are you a special case, do you have a medical need, and all that, then we can go back and forth. He says, but, as I began, ball playing, he says, he calls chiyusa di'aladim. Kids need to play ball. Even adults played ball in the time of Chazal, even though they weren't always so happy with that, he says, on Shabbos. But in general, ball playing, play is a human need, he says, especially for kids. And even if you're going to tell me, he said, let the kids go to the park, he said, little kids can't go to the park by themselves, and they need to play under their parents' watchful eyes, and things can be dangerous sometimes in the streets. He actually brings a pasuk in Zechariah to prove that ball playing is a normal thing. It says, Yeladim are Mesachakim Barachovos. The kids play in the streets. Even though then they play in the streets, he says, it was safe. Today it's not safe. They have to play locally. He says play is essential. Play is a non-negotiable human need. So he says shutting down the kids from playing ball is just intolerable. He brings proof from, again, precedents for this. that you can't expect people to not do something which is an inherent and essential part of normal human social life. Therefore, he says that you would not be allowed to ask for this if you're trying to shut down the ball playing. What you should do, he says, is negotiate, try to work out, to compromise certain hours of the day, what kind of games you can play. Just try to work out some way where they'll get their play in, but you'll get some peace and quiet. But if you can't, he says, then the halacha is you can't just shut them down, particularly because ball playing, he says, play is an essential need, especially for small children.